last two or three chapters. Let's start with the places. Of course, we have, let's do it this way. We have Judah. Judah, of course, is the southern kingdom. And who was the king of Judah beginning in Isaiah chapter 7? Not reason. Not Pekah. There you go. You're close there, Brother Dana. Yeah. Now we have Israel up here. Israel is just to the north of Judah. And who was the king of Israel, Brother Dana? You got a 50-50 shot there, don't you? Pekah, yeah, Pekah. Pekah was the king of Israel. I have to also review these when it's been two or three weeks since we've studied Isaiah. I go back and say, you know, I can't remember some of these things. Judah, Israel, Syria was another of the actors here. And who was the king of Syria? Rezin, R-E-Z-I-N. There's another actor in all of this. Who would that be, do you think? Well, certainly Isaiah, a person, but what about a nation? Assyria. Assyria sort of sits up to the north there of Syria, and they're lurking in the winds here in all of this. They're the big boy in all of this, and they're very strong at this time, and they're dominating all of the nations in the area. And the king of Assyria at this time is Tiglath-Pileser. Tiglath-Pileser is the king over Assyria. Now, Pekah and Rezin were feeling considerable pressure from Assyria in the north. They were afraid that Assyria was going to come down and take them as well. And so Tiglath-Pileser in Assyria was very aggressive. He was going forth to conquer every nation in the area. So in studying the history on this, it appears that Pekah and Rezin went down and wanted Ahaz to join them. What I'm gathering is that Pekah and Rezin kind of wanted Ahaz to band up with them so that they could stand against Assyria, but Ahaz would not help. He refused. And so they, Pekah and Rezin then said, okay, we'll go down and dethrone Ahaz and put our own king over Judah, and perhaps then we can unite and stand against Assyria. This is when God sent Isaiah to Ahaz. That's what we found in chapter 7, was that Isaiah went to Ahaz down in Judah. And he told Ahaz, don't worry about who? Don't worry about Pekah and Rezin. That's the good news. Because they will not be successful against you. But then he said, but worry about who? Assyria. Yeah, Assyria. Don't worry about Pekah and Rezin, but old Tiglath, his nation's going to come get you. So there was some good news, bad news going on there. When Assyria would finally come down against Judah, it would be very bad days. In fact, it would be the worst days since the kingdom divided. Take a look at chapter 7, verse 17. 7:17 says, the Lord shall bring upon thee and upon thy people and upon thy father's house days that have not come from the day that Ephraim departed from Judah. There's the division of the kingdom. Even the king of Assyria will come down. So there you have it. Assyria is going to be the one really to be afraid of. Well, Ahaz didn't pay too much attention to Isaiah's message. You remember that Ahaz was a very bad king. Ahaz set up all kinds of idols, and he led the people astray in many ways. So Ahaz tried to fashion an alliance with Assyria. Ahaz said, well, I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll just go up and make a pact with Assyria, and Assyria will protect me from Pekah and Rezin. So Ahaz wasn't depending on God's protection, but he depended on Assyria's protection. So Ahaz took gold and silver out of the temple and out of his own palace, and he marched up to Tiglath-Pileser and handed over the wealth of the kingdom to Assyria, hoping to buy Assyria's protection. In essence, he sold Judah into slavery to Assyria. When we come to chapter 8, again, the prophecy of destruction at the hands of Assyria is foretold. So the first eight chapters of chapter 8, we have another description of Assyria coming in to destroy the land. Now, in all of this, against the backdrop of judgment and destruction that was coming, there's also the promise of a deliverance for a remnant. So those are the two themes running hand in hand through Isaiah. And the good news is a deliverer is coming, ultimately. It's pretty clear throughout the book that the great deliverer is Christ. Just let's take a look at three or four of these little passages. Isaiah 2, 1 through 4. The word that Isaiah, the son of Amoz, saw concerning Judah and Jerusalem, and it shall come to pass in the last days that the mountain of the Lord's house, that's a kingdom. When you see a mountain, most of the time it's talking about a kingdom. The kingdom of the Lord's house shall be established in the top of the mountains. In other words, his kingdom will be above all kingdoms and shall be exalted above the hills, and all nations shall flow unto it. And many people shall go and say, come ye and let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob. He will teach us of his ways, and we will walk in his paths. For out of Zion shall go forth the law and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem, and he shall judge among the nations and rebuke many people, shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war any more. That seems to be describing, in my opinion, the kingdom of Christ. But at any rate, the Messiah is certainly at the center of whatever message of deliverance that we find in Isaiah. Take a look at Isaiah 4, 2-6. In that day shall the branch of the Lord, who is the branch of the Lord, do you think? Obviously Christ, right? So let's see, it shall come to pass that, in that day shall the branch of the Lord be beautiful and glorious, and the fruit of the earth shall be excellent and comely for them that are escaped of Israel. And it shall come to pass that he that is left in Zion and he that remaineth in Jerusalem, that's the remnant, whoever we're talking about, shall be called holy, even everyone that is written among the living in Jerusalem, that is the elect, it seems. When the Lord shall have washed away the filth of the daughters of Zion and shall have purged the blood of Jerusalem from the midst thereof by the spirit of judgment and by the spirit of burning. All right, so that's another little passage that talks about deliverance. Look at Isaiah 7 and verse 14. Therefore the Lord himself shall give you a sign. Behold, a virgin shall conceive and bear a son and shall call his name Emmanuel. So there you have another hint of this coming Messiah who is the focus of the deliverance. Take a look at Isaiah 9 and verse 2. The people that walked in darkness have seen a great light. Who do you think the great light is? Is it Christ? It seems to be Christ, doesn't it? And that's made even more clear in a moment. They that dwell in the land of the shadow of death, upon them hath the light shined. Thou hast multiplied the nation and not increased the joy. They joy before thee according to the joy in harvest, and as men rejoice when they divide the spoil. For thou hast broken the yoke of his burden and the staff of his shoulder, and so forth. Down in verse 6, for unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given, and the government shall be upon his shoulder. His name should be called Wonderful Counselor, the Mighty God, the Everlasting Father, the Prince of Peace, and of the increase of his government and peace. there shall be no end. So certainly in that passage it's clear, since that's quoted in the New Testament, it's clear that Christ is the focus of the deliverance that he is speaking about. Now let's go to Isaiah 9 and let's pick up in verse 8. I'm going to try to cover at least 9:8 through 10:4 tonight. And when we start with chapter 9 and verse 8, this is a message against Israel in the north. So this is a message directed toward Israel. Then when you look down to 10:4, you may have a heading in your Bible. Who is the message addressed against in 10, beginning in 10:5? Assyria. So now what we're going to have here is a couple of passages. In fact, as we move through the next few chapters, God is going to bring judgment on a lot of folks. But beginning tonight, we're talking about the Lord's anger against Israel. So let's start in verse 8. And to whom is the message addressed? Just read it. The Lord sent a word into what? Jacob. Now, Jacob a lot of times is a reference to Israel in general. In this particular case, it seems to be the Israel up in the north. And it says, and it hath lighted upon Israel, and all the people shall know, even Ephraim. Ephraim was a tribe in the north, and the inhabitant of Samaria. Where is Samaria? Is it in Judah or Israel? It's in Israel, of course. So it appears then that the message here, beginning in chapter 9 and verse 8, is addressed to Israel in the north. Now what we're going to see, and what I'm going to do is divide this up into sort of topics, and it will cover it through the whole passage. What we're going to see is the sin of Israel, which prompted the judgment. Now let's start in verse where it says pride and stoutness of heart. Let's see, where is that? Verse 9, yeah. And all the people shall know, even Ephraim and the inhabitant of Samaria, that say in the pride and stoutness of heart. That was their first sin, was pride. I think all of us know that pride is a very dangerous thing, right? Pride is a very, very serious matter in the scriptures. In fact, it says that pride goeth before what? Before a fall. There's also another verse in the Bible that says that pride goeth before shame. That is Proverbs 11:2. So be careful if you have pride in the hidden corners in your heart. We all need to get rid of that, because pride brings destruction. And so with regard to Israel, why was God going to bring judgment? Because the people say, in the pride and stoutness of their heart, they make certain statements. Well, secondly, not only was pride an issue, but self-sufficiency was an issue. This is found in verse 10. Let's read it. The last phrase of verse 9 says, that say in the pride and stoutness of heart, the bricks are fallen down, but we will build with hewn stones. The sycamores are cut down, but we will change them into cedars. Now, what did the people mean when they said that? Yeah. God may come and tear down our bricks. Oh, we'll just go out and find even better materials, stones, and we'll rebuild, you see. God may come and cut down our sycamores, but we'll just replant, and we'll plant cedars this time, you see. The idea is self-sufficiency, no fear of the Lord. God may do to us what he will, but we'll survive, and we will rebuild. So you have this idea then of self-sufficiency. The Bible says in Romans 3:18 about the ungodly, there is no fear of God before their eyes. And that would be a pitiful situation to be in when there's no fear of God before your eyes. Dangerous position to be in. And that was the position of the people in Israel. We'll just rebuild. No trouble. In verse 13, now let's take a look at another sin of the people. In verse 13, for the people turneth not unto him that smiteth them. Now all of these judgments that were coming on Israel, it seemed to be that it was at the hand of the Syrians or at the hand of the Assyrians, Philistines, the Egyptians. However, who was really the one that was disciplining Israel? It was God, of course. And in verse 13, 9:13, it says, that they would not turn unto him that smiteth him. So you have this non-repentant heart. Fourthly, there's another reason why God was angry with Israel, and this is found in verse 16. For the leaders of this people cause them to err, and they are led of them, they that are led of them are destroyed. So God was angry because they had evil leaders. That's sort of a scary thought, isn't it? That sometimes, you know, we're held accountable for the elite, the leaders that we have over us. And so was Israel. Verse 17, why else is God angry with them? In verse 17, therefore the Lord shall have no joy in their young men, neither shall have mercy on their fatherless and widows, for everyone is a hypocrite. Hypocrisy running rampant. They're a hypocrite and an evildoer. And every mouth speaketh folly. That word folly can be translated villainy. Evil, treacherous speaking. And so for these reasons, God is angry with them. There's another reason in verse 18. For wickedness burneth as the fire. Ever since Brother Mark has brought his lesson on figures in Sunday school, I notice them everywhere. And this is one of them. It says, for wickedness burns as the fire. So wickedness is compared to a fire, you see. The fire is the figure, and wickedness is what it really means. That's the substance of things. We're in verse 9:18. So wickedness is like a fire. It shall devour the briars and the thorns. Now, what does a fire do? Well, when a fire gets loose, it devours everything. Not only the structures, not only the big things, but it devours everything down to the briars and the bushes. And that's apparently what it's saying when it's talking about the wickedness of Israel. It also devours everything in the land. And therefore, God is not happy with the wickedness of Israel. I've got in my notes here, just as fire consumes everything, so wickedness consumes everything. Sin is ultimately no good for a people. Sin is like a cancer upon a people. It grows until it consumes the vital organs. Sin is a little fire that grows into an all-consuming fire. And that is the way it is pictured here, I think. There's another reason why God is angry with Israel. It's found in verse 21 of chapter 9. And it says, Manasseh, make sure I get the right verse. Verse 21, Manasseh, Ephraim, and Ephraim, Manasseh. What does that mean? We should have gone back to verse 20 to get you the context. He shall snatch on the right hand and be hungry, and he shall eat on the left hand, and they shall not be satisfied. They shall eat every man the flesh of his own arm. Now that's sort of harsh language there. And then it says, Manasseh, Ephraim, and Ephraim, Manasseh. Now what does that mean?
I think it's figurative.
Uh-huh.
And that what I'm reading, what it sounds like to me at least, is that Manasseh and Ephraim are fighting each other to destroy each other.
Yes. Manasseh, who were Manasseh and Ephraim, by the way? They were Joseph's sons. They were the two sons that inherited in lieu of Joseph, right? And of all the tribes in Israel, Manasseh and Ephraim should have loved each other more than the others, just naturally speaking, right? They were of the same father. And so when it talks about devouring your own arm, it's devouring your friend, devouring your family, your own family. And he sort of illustrates it by saying Manasseh will try to devour Ephraim, and Ephraim will try to devour Manasseh. And so God was not happy with the intense rivalry between brother tribes. They should not have warred against one another. They were one family in the Lord. And God is not happy with the warring between the tribes, especially the close tribes like Ephraim and Manasseh. In addition to that, in verse 21, there is another reason why God was bringing judgment on Israel. And what would they do in verse 21? They would come against Judah. They had designs against that southern nation from which they divided. And for all of these reasons, God is angry with Israel. But there's another reason why he is angry. And that begins in chapter 10, verse 1. Woe unto them that, what? Decree unrighteous decrees. That is, the legislators, the ones who sat in the high positions making laws, they made unrighteous laws. And God was angry with them for making what he calls here grievous laws. Verse 1 of chapter 10. They that write grievousness which they have prescribed. And so God is angry for that reason. Now, what kind of laws did they make that were grievous? Let's just look quickly. It says, to turn aside the needy from judgment. So apparently what they were doing is that they were not giving the needy fair judgments. I think the needy, the poor, have always complained that they didn't get a fair shake. Whether that's true or not, it shouldn't be true. All people should be equal under the law. There's a figure that we use in our law system of the person blinded by the bandana or whatever that goes over the eyes. That means that the law is blind as to who's rich and who's poor and so forth. That's the way laws should be. But evil men make laws that take advantage of others and that where they can prosper. God's not happy with that. And so they were making laws that were unduly burdensome on the needy. And to take away the right from the poor of my people. So these laws didn't stand the poor in good stead when they went to court. And that widows may be their prey. Let's make some money on the widows here. And they robbed the fatherless. So God was unhappy with the laws of Israel that took advantage of these needy folks. All right, now let's talk about the instruments of judgment. So let's go back to chapter 9 and verse 11, and let's run through again, and let's take a look at the instruments of judgment. How was God going to bring judgment on Israel? Verse 11, chapter 9, verse 11. Therefore the Lord shall set up the adversaries of reason against him. Who would have been the main adversary of reason? Assyria. So it seems to be talking about Assyria here. And it says, the Lord shall set up the adversaries of reason against him, being Israel, and join his enemies together. It seems that what it's talking about here is that Assyria would come down and conquer Syria, joining Syria and Assyria up, and Assyria would compel Syria now to attack Israel. That's what history seems to confirm happened as well. So we have the adversaries of reason, which is Assyria, joining up with Syria. So it says here in verse 12, the Syrians before and the Philistines behind. Now, you have to know your geography. If this is the Mediterranean Sea and this is Israel over here, where was Syria? Well, they bordered over on this side, right? And where was Philistia? Up and down the coastline here, like that. So Syria before. So when Israel turns to look at Syria, now the Philistines from behind, you see. So those are the instruments of God's judgment upon Israel. All right, let's take a look at the severity of the judgment. Start in verse 12. The Syrians before and the Philistines behind, and they shall devour Israel. Now, if you get devoured, that's pretty serious, isn't it? But it's even more illustrative here. It says, they shall devour Israel with what? Open mouth. They're not going to just come nibbling. They're going to come with a wide mouth, wide open, to devour them in whole. And so we have there then showing us the severity of the judgment. Notice in verse 14, it says in verse 14, therefore the Lord will cut off from Israel head and tail. What does that mean? What does it mean that he will cut them off head and tail? Well, yeah. That's one interpretation. Anybody have another idea? We're sort of left to speculate, aren't we, until we read the next verse, which tells us, it says in verse 15, the ancient and honorable, he is the head, and the prophet that teacheth lies, he is the tail. So what he's saying here is that these nations, particularly Syria and Philistines, are going to come in and they're going to cut off the honorable man and the dishonorable man. The old honorable man is going to suffer the judgment too, and also the dishonorable. And here, the dishonorable man, of course, is the lying prophets. So the head and the tail, the highest and the lowest, the best and the worst in Israel shall suffer the punishment. So it's pretty severe, isn't it? It's not just selective. It's everyone is going to suffer the judgment. The most noble and the most ignominious, the strongest and the weakest will be cut off. This is also illustrated by the figure of the branch and the rush. The branch being the more honorable, the rush, I think, being the brush and the less attractive grass, perhaps, below the plant. And so the idea is that good and bad, honorable and dishonorable, high and low, they shall be cut off. Verse 16, for the leaders of this people cause them to err, and they that are led of them are destroyed. You see that word destroyed? That gives you another sense of the severity of the judgment. They're not going to just be picked at partially, but they are going to be destroyed. And so we're getting a sense of the severity here. Look at verse 17. Therefore the Lord shall have no joy in their young men, neither shall have mercy on their fatherless and widows. So God is not going to have mercy on the young men, and he's not going to have mercy on who? The fatherless and the widows. You get it, starting to get a sense of the complete and utter destruction that is at hand. Verse 19, and the rest of the trees of his verse 19. I'm looking for the land will be darkened. That is in verse, where is it? 19? Oh, I'm reading from verse 10, chapter 10. Verse 19 of chapter 9. Through the wrath of the Lord of hosts is the land darkened. So that's another picture. And then it says that the people shall be as the fuel of the fire. Now, Brother Mark, this is another figure. So we have, if you have a fire, there's something that you put in the fire as fuel, isn't there? You either put gas or you put a log or sticks, whatever. There's the fire and there's the whatever it is that fuels the fire. And when God brings judgment on Israel, the people are going to be as the fuel for the fire, you see. They're going to be burned up in the fire of judgment. Pretty severe, isn't it? Not only will they be like the fuel for the fire, but in verse 20, there is going to be extreme famine. And he shall snatch on the right hand and be hungry, and he shall eat on the left hand, and they shall not be satisfied. They shall eat every man the flesh of his own arm. So that certainly appears to be a picture of famine. What does the word snatch convey to the mind? Well, it implies to me, Brother Mark.
I have a note that in the Hebrew is the word
cut. Cut? Okay. I'm trying to think of what that conjures up, but it seems to imply violence of some kind. There perhaps a violent grappling for food. That makes a lot of sense. If there's a famine in the land, everybody's starving to death, you're going to steal your neighbor's stuff. If you see it, you're going to grab it. And that's the way it will be. So they'd be willing to destroy each other in their desperate search for food. Let's look at chapter 10 and verse 4. Gives us another sense of the severity of the judgment. Verse 4, without me they shall bow down under the prisoners, and they shall fall under the slain. That's also a little difficult of interpretation, but I think the idea here is that they will fall in among the prisoners and the slain. When these judgments come against them, they will be among the prisoners. Right now, they are seeing prisoners dragged off by Assyria everywhere. But in their day of judgment, they also will share in the same fate as the prisoners, and also in with the slain. Everybody see the severity of the judgment that is coming upon Israel. All right, now I even have time to get into, verse 5 of chapter 10. Yes, sir.
Comment.
Sure.
You know, I can't help but see a lot of parallelism and figurative language, and I have been talking about how history doesn't use the parallel language in the figurative language. Mm-hmm. However, this is all written in prospect. This is all written as prophecy. That's why it can be written in a poetic form. Uh-huh.
Right. You are referring to that phrase, they will bow down under the prisoners and they shall fall under the slain.
That's one of them, but uh-huh. I see it almost everywhere in the whole.
Yeah, Yeah.
Several times.
All right. Thank you. That's a good thing to bring out.
It doesn't contradict what I was saying, I don't think, because this is written prospectively.
Right. Right. It's a little bit different from history because you don't just say, and this happened, and this happened, and this happened, but you're sort of prophesying what will happen, and it gives leeway for the use of this kind of poetic language. Yeah. Yeah, 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 it seems that God extends the offer of mercy as long as he can, as long as the people will turn away from their sins, God is still there. Of course, they would not do it. Yeah, let's get a sense of that. Where are they? Just
First 1, verse 12, 9-12.
Okay. But his hand is still stretched out. Yeah, sure is. Good point. That's one that I was not going to bring out here, but that does seem to be a recurring theme here, is that as bad as they were and as grievous as the judgment was planned for them, yet his arms were still stretched out. Oh, in judgment. Oh, okay. Oh, it could be. Mm-hmm. But his hand is stretched out still. Is that the way you... read it, that his hand was stretched out in judgment.
It says, for in all this his anger is not turned away, but his hand is stretched out still.
Good God.
His anger is not going to be turned away by how bad it gets. He's angry at sin.
Okay. I see that. If you get a chance during the week, why don't you pull out a commentary and see what they say about it, okay? What'd you say, Mary?
I only caught one place that he said
it. Yeah, 12, 17, 21, and 10:4. But his hand is stretched out still. Yeah, so
I think that's actually a parallel. It's the parallel which says the same thing twice.
Yeah.
The synonymous parallel.
Let me look into that. I'll just refer to it next time. That's a good point. Does it mean his hands are stretched out in mercy, or he's not turning his anger away and his hand is still stretched out to bring judgment to you? Good point. Okay. What you're going to notice in a lot of commentaries are not near as detailed in the Old Testament as they are in the New. They cover it more in general a lot of times. All right. When we start with chapter 10 and verse 5, now we are going to have a message to whom? Assyria. We've just got through talking about Israel. Now we're going to talk about a message to Assyria. First of all, who is the real power behind Assyria? God. God is the real power behind Assyria. Verse 5 says, O Assyrian, the rod of mine anger, and the staff in their hand is mine indignation. You see. I will send him. Who will God send? Assyria. I will send him against a hypocritical nation, and against the people of my wrath will I give him a charge. Let's talk about that for a minute. Israel, first of all, in verse 6, is sent. You see that? Israel is sent. Now, does God control wicked people? Yes. He sends them wherever he wants them to go. People don't understand that. It's incomprehensible how that's possible, and yet God is so sovereign and so powerful that he can send the wicked wherever he wants to send them. So you see here in verse 6 that Assyria is really sent by God. Not only that, in verse 6, he gives them a what? In verse 6, I give him a charge. What's the charge? That's an order. I'm ordering them to go, you see. So God sends Assyria. He orders them to go against Israel in verse 6. All right, so that's the real nature of things. But what does the heart of the Assyrian tell him? Let's take a look at that. In verse 7, it says, howbeit he meaneth not so, neither does his heart think so. Now, when it's talking about him, who are we talking about? The Assyrian. Howbeit he, the Assyrian, meaneth not so. He doesn't think he is sent by God. He doesn't think God has ordered him to go. That's not what the Assyrian's heart is telling him. The Assyrian's not even considering God at all. May not even know at all about the real God. So he doesn't mean it so. When he marches down into Israel with swords, he doesn't think that he's carrying out a rod of discipline from God, nor that he has been charged to go by God. But it is in his heart to what? In verse 7, it is in his heart to destroy and to cut off nations, not a few. The thing that's in the Assyrian's heart is he wants to go lop off some heads and conquer all of these nations. And so so we've seen now what is in the heart of the Assyrian. The Assyrian says, I am not acting on behalf of the God of Israel. I don't even know that God. I don't talk to him. The God of Israel does not give me orders. In fact, I have contempt for the God of Israel. I'm about to go destroy them. That's what the Assyrian is thinking, you see. Does that remind you of anything in the book of Acts with regard to the crucifixion? This is just like the men who nailed Jesus to the cross. They were also God's instruments, and yet they were doing it out of wicked hearts, weren't they? All right. So his intent is not to do God's work, but his intent is to do harm. That's why he can be held accountable, even though he's ultimately accomplishing God's work. All right, so his intent is to do harm. He wants to destroy and to cut off many nations. Take a look at what motivates the Assyrian here. Look at verse 8. Is it verse 8? Let's take a look. Yeah, look at verse 8, 10 verse 8. He says, are not my princes altogether kings? What does that mean? What that seems to mean is that my servants are as powerful as the kings of other nations. So he's puffed up in pride. The king of Assyria is puffed up. And he said, my princes are like kings everywhere else. And so he's very proud and arrogant. Then he says in verse 9, is not Calno as Carchemish? Is not Hamath as Arpad? Is not Samaria as Damascus? What he's saying there is not, isn't one nation just like another nation to me? It doesn't matter whether you're strong or weak. I'm coming in and I'm going to take you. And so I think in this case, Calno perhaps was the stronger one, and Carchemish was the weak one. It doesn't matter to Assyria whether you're weak or strong, high or low. he's going to come get you. And so you see his arrogance here. Also, he says in verses 10 and 11, let's read that, as my hand hath found the kingdoms of the idols, and whose graven images did excel them of Jerusalem and Samaria, shall I not, as I have done unto Samaria and her idols, so do to Jerusalem and her idols? Now what he's saying there is that I have conquered kingdoms whose idols, that is their religious system, their idols were greater than Israel's idols. I conquered kingdoms whose religion was greater than Israel's. That's what he thought. And so you see his arrogance here, and he says, I'm going to destroy the idols of Jerusalem just like I destroyed the idols of all other nations. I will destroy Jerusalem's God just like I destroyed their gods. You can see what this must be kindling the anger in God's heart. So the king of Assyria had very little respect for the religion of Israel. He was showing contempt for the Jewish religion. And the religion of the Jews was no better than the religion of the other nations that he had conquered. Now we're going to take a look quickly at what God will do to Assyria, beginning in verse 12. Wherefore it shall come to pass that when the Lord hath performed his whole work upon Mount Zion and on Jerusalem, I will punish the fruit of the stout heart of the king of Assyria and the glory of his high looks. Now let's take a look at that verse. And when will God do it to Assyria? Yeah, when God has accomplished his work, when he has thoroughly used up Assyria for his purposes, then God will turn on Assyria and judge Assyria. All right, why will God do it? Look at verses 13 and 14. For he saith, by the strength of my hand I have done it, and by my wisdom. Now, who is saying that? The king of Assyria. For he saith, that is, the king of Assyria saith, by the strength of my hand I have done it. I think God hates that. God likes his own glory. And he does not like it when a man says, I have done it. And by my wisdom I have done it. Then he says, for I am prudent, and I have removed the bounds of the people and have robbed their treasures. And I have, the emphasis I think on the I have put down the inhabitants like a valiant man. And so he was proud of his own valor, wasn't he? So God will turn on Assyria because of the king's arrogance and pride of his own self. Also, God will turn on Assyria because Assyria has robbed other people. You don't get away with this. Nations think they do if they're stronger than someone else. They just go in and take their stuff. But you ultimately don't get away with things with God. Look at verses 13 and 14. Last part of verse 13 says, I have removed the bounds of the people and have robbed their treasures. Oh, how proud the king of Assyria was because he took everybody's stuff. And then in verse 14, and my hand hath found as a nest the riches of the people. Now there you again, you have another figure. What is the figure here? You have a bird's nest. And what is typically in a bird's nest?
Eggs.
And Tiglath-Pileser, or whoever the subsequent king was in Assyria, would rob people just like someone robs eggs out of a nest. Can you imagine how the people felt when Tiglath came in and robbed them? You know, when an enemy comes in and just casts you aside and takes your stuff, it would be like someone climbing up the tree and finding a little bird's nest. And he would crush the little baby birds or throw them to the ground, and he would rob the eggs from the nest. And the sad part about it is no one was strong enough to even lift a voice against him. The mama bird could not even lift her wings against him, it says in verse 14. As one gathereth eggs that are left, have I gathered all the earth, and there was none that moved the wing. You see, the mama bird apparently was not even strong enough to flap her wings to stop the robbery. She was not strong enough to open her mouth, it says, against him, and the little baby birds could not even make a peep. And Tiglath just came in and took the eggs away from Israel, you see. Yeah, right. Just came in and slaughtered the... Yeah, and the point is here that Assyria and the king of Assyria are ripe for judgment, aren't they? Because they're robbing the treasuries. We're almost through. Take a look now at the foolishness of the king of Assyria. This is found in verse 15. Now, again, there are going to be four figures used here. You're going to have the figure of the axe, the figure of the saw, the figure of the rod, and the figure of the staff. Now, in verse 15, shall the axe boast itself against him that heweth therewith? Now, in the figure, the lumberjack uses the axe, right? The axe is just an instrument. That represents God using Assyria. Assyria is the axe, right? And so does the axe, who is just an instrument, boast itself against the swinger of the axe? Secondly, does the saw magnify itself against him that shaketh it? No. Once again, the instrument doesn't boast himself against the user. Does the rod, as if the rod should shake itself against them that lift it up, or as the staff should lift up itself, as if it were no wood? So you see the foolishness of the king of Assyria, who is nothing more than the axe, the saw, the rod, and the staff. So you see here that Tiglath had no concept of who he really was. In our example here, he was just a piece of wood in the hands of God. If we're talking about the rod and the staff, he's just a piece of wood, and yet he lifted himself up as if he were somebody. Lastly, not quite lastly, but what God will do to Assyria in verses 16 through 19. Let's just take a very brief look at it. Verse 16, therefore shall the Lord of hosts, send among his fat ones leanness. What is that? Famine. Famine is going to come on Assyria. Secondly, in verse 17, and the light of Israel shall be for a fire, and his Holy One for a flame, and it shall burn and devour his thorns and his briars in one day. It seems that is another figure. It's going to be like fire devours his kingdom. That speaks of utter destruction. Take a look at what would be burned up. In verse 20? 18. What will be burned up in Assyria? Well, his forest. Verse 17. It shall burn and devour his thorns and his briars. That is the very brush. Down to the essential elements. All of that will be burned up. His forest will be burned up in verse 18. His fruitful field will be burned up in verse 18. Also in verse 19, what will be burned up there? Excuse me, I'm still in 18. Soul and body. And they shall be as when a standard bearer fainteth. Now that tells us how Israel is going to feel, how Assyria is going to feel in that day. How will they feel? Terrified. When they marched into war, they would march with a banner, proudly, or a flag. This is us. We're great. But when the flagman would fall, it would strike terror into the people, and that's the way it's going to be with Assyria. So they're going to feel panic. So, all right, I found in Wikipedia this interesting statement here. I was trying to read some of the history of Assyria. Let me just read this, and I'll tell you when I get to the good part. In the 7th century, Jerusalem grew to contain a population many times greater than earlier and achieve clear dominance over its neighbors. This occurred at the same time that Israel was being destroyed by Assyria and was probably the result of a cooperative arrangement with the Assyrians to establish Judah as an Assyrian vassal, controlling the valuable olive industry. Judah prospered as an Assyrian vassal state, but in the last half of the 7th century BC, Assyria suddenly collapsed. That's history. That's what Wikipedia says happened to Assyria. Isaiah foretold all of this.